They banned a word they could not define, and then tried to beat it out of an entire people. In Jamaica, late in the 18th century, white lawmakers sat down and wrote an act against something they called Obeah. They did not explain exactly what it was. They simply poured into that single word almost anything African and spiritual that made them afraid, charms sewn into clothes, powders slipped into food, midnight rituals at the edge of the cane fields, whispers that a man could call spirits to kill or cure. On paper, Obeah became a crime that could bring whipping, prison, even death, if anyone linked it to rebellion. In real life, it was not one clean religion. It was the name the colonial state gave to a whole hidden universe it refused to understand. But here is the problem that never goes away. For more than 200 years, we have had the laws against Obeah in black ink, preserved and quoted. What we do not have in the same way is the lived record of what people actually did, believed, and felt when they went to an Obeah worker, a voodoo priest, a Santeria house, or a Shango feast. The written archive is loud on punishment, quiet on practice. That silence is the mystery at the heart of this episode. The state left us detailed instructions on how to destroy these traditions. It left almost nothing that truly explains why they would not die. To understand that gap, we need to start with the basic. Unforgiving reality underneath everything. The Caribbean was built as a slave society. European empires took islands like Hispaniola, Jamaica, Cuba, Barbados, and Trinidad. They shattered indigenous Taino and Kalinago worlds through disease, warfare, and forced labor. Then they turned the region into a machine, importing hundreds of thousands of Africans from many regions with many languages and religious systems on plantations. Those systems collided with one another, and with Catholic or Protestant forms pushed by priests, pastors, and overseers. From that collision came new Creole spiritual worlds. In Saint-Domingue, later Haiti, enslaved Africans forged voodoo, a system rooted in West and Central African cosmologies, reshaped through the daily terror of slavery. Spirits known as Lua received songs, drumming, offerings, and possession. In Cuba, Yoruba-derived Orisha worship braided itself with Catholic saints and local practices into what would be known as Santeria and related traditions. In Trinidad, Shango and other Orisha-based forms took hold. In Jamaica and parts of the Eastern Caribbean, colonial voices used the word Obeah as a bag that swallowed almost any African-derived spiritual work outside church walls, while revival and mile spiraled Bible language, spirit possession, and African ways of knowing into new forms. On the ground, these were not exotic side notes. They were tools for survival. Enslaved people turned to spirits, ancestors, and ritual to heal illnesses. The plantation doctor ignored, to seek protection from violence, to read dreams, to understand why a child died or a harvest failed. Spiritual leaders could also be political organizers. Colonial authorities watched nervously as certain healers became respected figures, able to gather people quietly after dark. After Jamaica's Tackies Rebellion in 1760, officials blamed Obeah men for lighting the fuse and promised brutal punishment for anyone found with a charm, a bottle of medicine, or even an object that looks suspicious. Now shift the frame. Imagine the plantation not from the master's balcony, but from the packed slave village at the end of the day. The air is thick with the smell of sweat, smoke, and molasses. Bodies ache from cutting cane from dawn until last light. Skin carries the memory of lashes. Food is basic. Disease moves fast. In that space, someone pulls a small bundle from under a sleeping mat, cloth tied with hair, herbs, maybe a tiny bone. Fingers trace it like a memory. It is not decoration. In this world, a guard against sickness or ritual before a dangerous task is not superstition in the lazy sense. It is one of the few defenses a person feels they still control. In this micro scene, we move into present tense because this is how the pressure feels when you stand in it. Night falls. You are there in the dirt yard. You can hear a drum start softly, then stop when an overseer passes. You see someone pour a little liquid on the ground before drinking, a quiet offering to a spirit or ancestor. You know that if the wrong person watches too closely, this small act could be reported as Obeah, and yet it continues. The risk is real, but so is the need for a world where the master is not the only power that matters. Looking at the written record, you mostly see that world from outside. Missionaries complain that enslaved people go to church on Sunday and still trust in charms on Monday. They write reports about people wearing crosses and carrying Bibles while also keeping fetishes or visiting sorcerers. They call this confusion or stubbornness. Planters write fearful letters about infernal ceremonies, midnight dances, drums of rebellion. Laws are passed with simple, sharp language. Anyone pretending to have supernatural powers, anyone giving advice by Obeah, anyone found with instruments of Obeah will be punished. What you rarely see in those same documents is a clear voice from the other side. You do not get a long statement from a woman who says, "I went to this healer because my baby had a fever and I had no money for medicine." You do not get a confession of fear or hope from a man who carries a charm into the field because he believes it might bend the whip away from his back. When those people show up in the archive, it is at the moment of accusation, when they are already on the defensive, speaking through translators, facing a judge or a missionary. Their words are summarized, corrected, or mocked. This is what it means in practice for the archive to be built by power. As empires tried to stamp out African-derived spiritual work, they also tried to pull people into their own religious systems. Catholic and Protestant churches offered baptism, marriage, burial, and a different kind of community. Many enslaved and later free people embraced these forms sincerely. But the adoption of Christianity did not always mean abandoning older spirits. In Haiti and Cuba, Vodou and Santeria folded saints and Bibles into their own logic. A Catholic saint became the public face of an African deity. A rosary could be both a Christian object and a tool in a Vodou ritual. In Jamaica, revivalist movements claimed the Holy Spirit with intense possession, visions, and healing, while still carrying echoes of older African ways of dealing with the invisible. The word syncretism is often used here. It makes the process sound balanced, as if each tradition brought equal weight to the table and simply blended. That is not what actually happened. The blend took place inside a system where European forms had legal protection and social prestige, and African ones carried the threat of punishment. Enslaved and colonized people adopted and repurposed Christian images partly because they wanted them and partly because they had to hide under them. A shrine with a saint's statue was more likely to survive a police raid than a shrine filled only with unfamiliar African figures. Emancipation in the 19th century changed the legal ground, but not the deep suspicion. Freed people built their own churches and carved out new spaces for worship. Revival bands marched with drums and banners. Baptist and Methodist chapels became centers of community life. Yet anti-Obeah and anti-superstition laws stayed in force, often justified as protection for the poor against fraud. Police continued to raid practitioners, seize objects, and destroy sacred spaces. Newspapers published sensational stories about Obeah men exposed, their strange collections laid out for ridicule, bottles of colored liquid, bones, herbs, dolls, coins. Once again, think in the present tense for a moment. You are a spiritual worker in the early 20th century. People come to you in secret. A mother brings a sick child. A young man wants protection from an enemy at work. A woman fears her partner is unfaithful or dangerous. You listen. You prepare baths, powders, prayers. You mix psalm verses with herbs, candlework with whispered names of spirits. You are both respected and feared. At the same time, you know that if someone denounces you, police may burst into your home, drag you to court, and display your tools as evidence of crime. Your practice lives in a narrow corridor between community need and state punishment. Over the 20th century, these spiritual worlds moved, fragment by fragment, into the open and into culture. Haitian painters made Vodou altars and spirits visible on canvas. Cuban musicians drew on Santeria rhythms and chants in rumba and later in salsa and jazz. Trinidadian and Jamaican artists used Shango and Obeah as symbols of black power, fear, and resistance. Novels and poems began to treat these traditions not only as backward superstition, but as serious sources of meaning. At the same time, film, television, and outsiders' journalism often repeated old colonial fears, turning Vodou and Obeah into horror props, zombies, curses, blood-soaked rituals. Migration added another layer. Afro-Caribbean people moving to New York, London, Toronto, and beyond brought their spirits with them. Some established Vodou temples, Santeria casas, and Orisha communities. Others kept their practice quiet, working in apartments, back rooms of shops, or community halls. In diaspora, these traditions attracted not only people from the islands, but also African Americans, Afro-Latinos, and others drawn to a spirituality that felt rooted in African ancestry and resistant to white-dominated institutions. For many, this was not just religion. It was a way to repair a sense of historical fracture, to say the chain did not break completely at the ship, the auction block, or the plantation. Meanwhile, the law lagged and revealed its own loyalties. In some territories, old anti-Obeah statutes remained on the books, barely in force, but still available. In others, debates erupted about whether to repeal or modernize them. Supporters of repeal pointed out that these laws targeted mostly black practices, written in a time when black people had almost no legal power. They asked why claims of spiritual power in churches were treated as faith, while similar claims outside churches were treated as fraud. Opponents worried about exploitation of the vulnerable or argued, sometimes openly, sometimes not, that too much freedom in this area would invite chaos. These debates expose a hard question: who gets to decide what is religion, what is culture, and what is crime? In the Caribbean, those decisions have never been neutral. From the start, white planters, missionaries, and officials framed African-derived spiritual work as dangerous and primitive, even when they borrowed from it in private. They framed their own churches as civilized and moral, even when they blessed slave ships and sugar estates. That double standard wove itself into laws, school systems, and public language. It still shapes who feels free to name their gods in public, and who still whispers. For listeners in the wider African diaspora, and for anyone trying to understand Caribbean history honestly, this story forces us to confront our own training. Many of us learn to fear these traditions automatically. We heard that Obeah is evil, that voodoo is demonic, that Santeria is spooky or strange, long before we learned anything about how they actually function in people's lives. Others flip to the opposite extreme, romanticizing them as pure resistance or as aesthetic, without grappling with the heavy costs that people paid to keep them alive. The real work sits in the middle, treating these systems as serious, complex attempts to wrest meaning, protection, and power from a world organized against black survival. The mystery that started with the Obeah laws remains unresolved in a certain sense. We still do not have perfect access to the inner logic of every ritual, the emotional texture of every ceremony, the private conversations between practitioners and clients in 1850 or 1970. Some of that is gone forever. Some of it is deliberately kept within communities, and that boundary deserves respect. What we do have is enough to see patterns. We can see that colonial authorities wrote laws not because these practices were trivial, but because they were effective at shaping how people thought, feared, and hoped. We can see that the people targeted by those laws did not fold. They adapted, disguised, blended, and persisted. So the question for us is not whether a single ritual works in a supernatural sense. The question is what we do with this inheritance now. In a region and a diaspora where old laws still linger, where Afro-Caribbean spiritual symbols are sold on T-shirts and album covers while practitioners face stigma, and where some churches still teach that all of this is darkness, how do we choose to remember and name these traditions? Do we continue to treat them as suspicious leftovers from a primitive past? Do we turn them into aesthetic props divorced from their communities? Or do we recognize them as part of a long fight over who gets to claim the right to define God, spirit, healing, and justice? Here is the split that will show up in the comments and in our own minds. When you hear the word Obeah, or voodoo, or Santeria, do you instinctively hear danger, or do you hear survival?